The RTE Rugby Podcast.
And hello from Damien O'Mara. You're very welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Plenty to chat about this week. We will reflect on round three of the RBS Six Nations. Look ahead to the tournament's conclusion, where the championship silverware may be destined to go, and have a chat about Conor O'Shea's Fox. All of that and more to come over the course of the next half an hour. And delighted to say it will all play out in the company of Donal Lenihan, who joins us from RTE Studios in Cork. Donal, how are you?
Very good, Damien.
Thanks for joining us, as always. I suppose there's only one place we can really start, the Aviva Stadium last weekend. Arm wrestle, probably not a game for one that will end up on the highlights reel for the RBS Six Nations in years to come. But are you seeing a development in Ireland? Are you seeing progression or Joe Schmidt's side since that Scotland defeat that is enough perhaps to propel them firmly back into championship contention?
Yeah, I think we have throughout the course of the championship. I think we're very much in the running to compete with England on that last day. Hopefully it'll be a great day in Dublin. Paddy's weekend, everybody looking forward to it. You know, I think apart from that, the opening 25-30 minutes against Scotland was very poor. For whatever reason, Ireland were off the pace. I think certainly from a mental perspective that day, which you rarely see from a Joe Schmidt side, bounce back spectacularly against Italy, in that they did everything that they needed to do. And, you know, when you saw how competitive Italy were against England, and, you know, that's something we're going to talk about, maybe that puts Ireland's 63 points into perspective. I thought there was a lot of very positive aspects out of the performance against France. I was one of those who certainly felt there has been an incremental improvement in this French side under Guy Novès. Very impressive against England in the opening game in Twickenham, a game they could have won. Struggled a little bit against Scotland, but beat them. And they certainly put it up to Ireland in that opening 20 minutes of the game. I think it will concern Joe Schmidt that Ireland were slow out of the blocks in two of the three championship games to date. But, you know, in the second half against Scotland, and certainly in the second half against France, they showed a capacity to work their way back into the game. And, you know, beating France by 10 points, it's our biggest victory over them in the Six Nations for a long, long time. So I think a lot to be positive about.
And then what about areas for concern?
I think, as I mentioned, just the fact that they were dominated again for that opening 15-minute period. I think slightly lucky that Gael Ficou knocked on the ball at a time when the Lamoraux try was disallowed. I mean, France could have been 10-0 up. Then you're looking at a different proposition. Aspects of attack, I think, as well, that need to be tidied up, even if I thought there was a lot more variety to the Ireland game. Johnny Sexton, without question, adds a huge amount to that aspect of play, and that's, you know, not taking anything from Paddy Jackson, who's had a very good campaign, in fact a very good series of games for Ireland over the past number of months. But Sexton does offer that little bit more. I thought the likes of Gary Ringrose, for me, is getting better and better with every game. There was a suggestion, it was just within an inch or two of getting away, making serious line breaks on a number of occasions against France. It's going to be more difficult against Wales because defensively they're, you know, the way they play. But I think scope for improvement certainly in attack from a defensive perspective, you know, given the issues that we've had out wide in some of the earlier games. The fact that we kept France tryless is a huge plus. But, you know, this Welsh game is going to be a different proposition again.
On Sexton, did he put any doubt to bed that if he's fit, he has to play?
Without question. Look, Paddy Jackson is a developing international footballer. He's had to play. What I admire most about Jackson is he was thrown in as a young age at international level when he wasn't ready. He was thrown into a Heineken Cup final with Ulster when he wasn't ready. Those outings didn't go particularly well, but he showed fantastic temperament in working his way back in from those disappointments. South Africa, three test series, I thought he was excellent in having to sort of pick up the mantle from Johnny Sexton. He is developing his game, whereas Sexton as an international 10 is the finished article. That is the difference between the two of them at the moment. There is a confidence level that comes from playing as often as Johnny Sexton has done. He's been on Lions tours, and that gives you presence. It gives you an ability to lead those people around you. And, you know, that is something that Jackson will do in time. but is still learning his trade, and that's the key difference.
There's been so much focus on Ian Madigan not being in the squad, and I don't necessarily want to go over that ground again, but when you look at it, Ian Madigan, 27 years of age, Paddy Jackson, 25 years of age, Joey Carberry, 21 years of age. On mats alone, does Jackson have to become the second priority because, or sorry, not the second priority, but does he have to become maybe the priority standby because of his age and invest in him because he and Carberry, we would presume, are the future of that Irish role?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't say that. I mean, Ian Madigan, 27 years of age, who knows? We know now that he wants to get out of France. He's not happy there. If he were to come back to Ireland, and he suggested that that is a possibility, regardless, you know, depending on which province he'd go back to. But sure, the whole thing could turn around in 12 months' time. I mean, he'd get an opportunity, I would imagine. There, we know there are offers, I think, for him to go to England and play in the Premiership. But he has already fallen foul to the fact that playing out of the country doesn't endear you to Joe in terms of selection. So that's a decision now. It's an interesting decision for him in that the next time when he sits down, before he signs a contract, if he goes to the Aviva, given the progress that Paddy Jackson and Joey Carberry have made, then he puts himself at the back of the pile. If for argument's sake he decided that he was going to sign for Connacht, then I think it's all bets are off. Johnny Sexton is the leading light, and then the other three are fighting for the second position.
Just in terms of looking ahead now to the Wales game, you know, people are already again consuming themselves with the possibility of a championship decider in Dublin on St Patrick's weekend, and we hope that's the case. But to go face a very, very wounded Welsh outfit who won't want to come away from a Six Nations championship with a duck egg in terms of performances in Cardiff.
No, they won't. And, you know, in some respects, I'd be more fearful of this Welsh game than I would of the England game in Dublin. You know, I think if we get through and beat Wales, the English game will take care of itself for all kinds of reasons. But as you mentioned, Wales, I mean, I've watched them through the November series. They won three out of the four matches, but they never really hit the heights that they have in previous seasons. They've had a weird Six Nations in a way in that, you know, they beat Italy away, but it took them up to the last 15 minutes of that game to get on top of Italy. I thought they were outstanding in defeat against England and should have won that game. I think would have won that game had Jonathan Davies found touch with those two or three minutes to go. And having been in a commanding position against Scotland, and, you know, we saw how difficult they were when we went over there at the start of the championship to play in Murrayfield. Wales really should have blown them away in the opening half. They butchered two or three try-scoring opportunities. Rhys Webb at scrum half was outstanding. Jonathan Davies made a length of the field break, but just couldn't link with Webb at the end of it. And then, for whatever reason, they fell apart. I mean, they lost the second half by 20 points to nil. So therefore, it's difficult to assess really where this Welsh side are. They're a bit all over the place. And I think Rob Holy is under severe pressure with Gatland is used to that type of pressure. There are selection issues hanging over their team. A lot of people think that Sam Davies from the Ospreys should be the starting 10 over Dan Bigger, his club colleague. Issues in the back row with the likes of Faletau on the bench and the balance of that back row with both Warburton and Tipperick there. So there seems to be a degree of confusion within the Welsh setup at the moment. But if they get it right, both in selection and in mindset, and bear in mind this game against us is going to be 8 o'clock on a Friday night. You may not have as many Irish people there as you would on a weekend game. And you've been there in the past. You know what the Millennium Stadium is like, or the Principality as it is these days. It is a cauldron. And, you know, if Wales manage to get those selection calls right and they click on the night, then they will create problems for Ireland.
And to talk about the pressure from outside the squad, rugby is the number one sport. The soccer team have had great success in the last couple of years. That you can only imagine the pressure, the intensity, the scrutiny that the Welsh rugby players have been under on their downtime over the last couple of days. And the last thing you want is a Welsh squad that's festering in the Vale in Glamorgan for 10 days waiting to be unleashed on Ireland.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's happening. And there is no pressure like the pressure of a losing Welsh team in Wales. You know, having spoken about this at length to people like Graham Henry and Warren Gatland, who I think neither of them really appreciated the depth and the fervour of rugby in Wales until they actually went over there and lived in the country. And the Welsh players, there is no respite for them. There's no place to hide. And they've been getting an earful now for the past since that Scotland game finished. They will be difficult. The question is, are they good enough?
How big a factor is the Welsh Rugby Union's permission to Gatland to walk away for the Lions again? I know everything in hindsight we can look to rejudge, but is that a significant part of the challenge for Howley to walk back in there? Well, particularly when you factor in that you look at the Welsh management team, they have been there in situ for a long, long time now. The same voices delivering whatever message it is to the same group of players.
Yeah, I think that is a problem. And I think the Welsh Rugby Union, they've been very generous to Warren Gatland in his time away from the Lions, away on Lions duty. It's the second time he's had a sabbatical. Now, they can look back to the period, I think, in 2013 when he took the sabbatical. I think they ended up winning the championship.
Howley led them to the championship.
Yeah, having lost their opening game. Many thought it would be a case of history repeating itself, but this defeat to Scotland, I think, has stung them, particularly because they had the winning of that game within their grasp, had they taken those opportunities. I'd have question marks over the quality and the ability of their front five, and I think that has been an issue for them. I mean, everybody, Ireland, France in particular, had destroyed that Scottish scrum in the opening two matches. Wales struggled against them. So it's like everything else. If you don't have a platform up front, you can have the greatest backline in the world, but they're going to struggle. And I think there is a little bit of that happening. Plus, Jamie Roberts isn't starting for them anymore. Scott Williams, I think, is an outstanding player. So they seem to be caught in two minds about how they want to play the game. And I think that's an issue for them as well.
When we look at the game at the weekend, you know, okay, if we reverse a couple of weeks, we went into the Six Nations Championship. There was no debate in some quarters that Dylan Hartley would be the Lions captain. You fast forward a couple of weeks, there's no debate that Alan Wynne-Jones will be the Lions captain. And both have now in recent weeks had situations where their captaincy has been called into question. And Alan Wynne-Jones, when he watches the tape back of the weekend's game, will it make for difficult viewing?
I think it's something that he'd regret at this stage. I mean, personally, I would have said up to last Saturday, and I don't know, I haven't thought about it too much since. But if you asked me last week who my choice for the Lions captain would be, it would have been Alan Wynne-Jones, for a number of reasons. Firstly, he's been on two Lions tours before. I think that's hugely important. Secondly, I think despite the fact that there is huge competition for the second row, like the Lions will bring five second rows to New Zealand. But the competition, even for those five slots, is absolutely huge. But I would see Alan Wynne-Jones as a test starter. He captained the Lions in that third test in Australia 4 years ago, so he has pedigree there as well. For all those reasons, he was my choice. I'm not so sure I'd be as quick to flip that on the basis of one bad call or sort of a lack
or
of...
Or being overruled by a teammate.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there's been times in the past when Paul O'Connell was captain of Ireland, if Ronan O'Gara says, no, I don't want to kick here or I want to go there, then that decision can be changed. Like, that is trust and it is experienced heads coming together. I think probably too much has been made of that incident. If you were to ask me about Dylan Hartley, personally, I would never have... I wouldn't have put him in the reckoning to be a Lions captain for all kinds of reasons. But I think, firstly, you've got to see, does he deserve to be in the test team? The way he's playing at the moment, he shouldn't be in the Lions squad. I mean, you're going to bring... They'll bring three hookers, but his form doesn't warrant being selected on a Lions squad at present. I think he's in a scenario where, because of all the issues surrounding his disciplinary problems over the years... And particularly then, given the most recent one, Sean O'Brien, when he came off the bench for Northampton against Leinster, I think the guy is actually spooked at the moment in that he's afraid to play his natural game. Eddie Jones, I'd say, has given him his last chance by naming him as captain for the Six Nations, despite the fact that he was out for those number of weeks, having been suspended after the O'Brien incident. But he has done nothing on the field to justify his position. If you look at the captaincy issue, and you know, this is something we'll probably get into at the moment in relation to the furore that's around with the tactics that Italy brought to Twickenham on Sunday, then Hartley, from a captaincy perspective, did nothing for me to suggest that in the cold heat of battle against New Zealand down in Wellington or in Auckland, that he's going to do anything inspirational to lead the Lions out of trouble.
Well, I tell you what then, you've brought it up. Let's press on and talk about events at Twickenham. And Conor O'Shea's fox, as it has been dubbed, has got an awful lot of scrutiny over the course of the week. Conor himself chatted to Gary Moran earlier this week. Gary asked him about coming up with the idea for those tactics at Twickenham and the controversy that has resulted in the aftermath and when the decision came about.
We just spoke about it during the week after the Irish game, really, and we said we'd have a good chat when we're all together on the Sunday evening as coaches. And I mean, nothing revolutionary. We had watched, and we're actually discussing a penalty that we thought was should have been against Conor Murray, and we kind of got clarification about it. And then we just started thinking back about a few other things that had happened, and went, "Well, why don't we just do it? Because it's the law. It's not like." There are other things that happen in matches, and I think back to the Welsh game from our perspective that we felt very hard done by because with the law not being refereed at all, like people being illegal, what we did was completely legal. And if we'd gone out just doing the same thing, we have a lot to change in Italian rugby, but it'll take time. So we just want to make sure that we become, as I said, more competitive. And we were hurt after the Ireland game, and we said, well, we're going to go for it. We kicked into the corners, we attacked off scrums, we didn't roll over. But we also wanted to do something to get the ball back. And we thought, well, let's give it a crack and roll the dice a little bit. So we left that meeting as coaches and said, OK, we're going to sell this to the players, as, you know, give them hope that we're going to win a match, that we're not going to roll over. And 70 minutes into the match, it was 2 points in it. So we nearly pulled it off, but not quite.
And you spoke to referee Roman Poit the day before, as he normally would ahead of the game. And what's strange to me is that he explained that there was a law change, or at least an interpretation of a law change, just within the past week or so. And to me, it's surprising that a Six Nations coach isn't aware, or isn't made aware, that something has changed.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a change to the law. It was the referees that had a meeting, and it was the interpretation of a law, and more the spirit of the game. So it had happened during that week. So it wasn't a change to the law, but the referees. So yes, I mean, it was... When you say it's surprising that we weren't, I'd agree with that. But we just went back. And in many ways, we agreed in terms of what was being said, in terms of not playing that nine when they went outside the meter or when they played the ball. So actually, we're probably more comfortable in our own minds about what it was. We had a good discussion with Roman about it and went back and just... We've been... practicing all week, and I think, you know, people, if they're watching the warm-up, they probably might have got a clue. You always look at opposition warm-ups, and that we're practicing quite a lot on tackling and rolling and not standing around that contact area. And we've done a lot of work during the week just rolling on big mattresses, so to speak, to get the mindset of tackle and roll. So there's weaknesses in every defense, but we just roll the dice. And I think, you know, there's a lot probably has gone missing is the fact that we actually... if our set piece again had functioned, our line out had functioned a bit better, but England are good at contesting. We created a lot of field position, a lot of territory, a bit like that first half against Wales. And I said 70 minutes into the match, it was 17-15, and we had a scrum on halfway, which probably ended up with all the turning points in matches being the final turning point in that game. So we have a lot to do, Gary, a lot to do, but hopefully people are seeing in the short term we're just going to be a little bit inventive to try and make sure that we get an edge and in the long term make the changes that need to be made in Italian rugby.
There's certainly been sour grapes. Nobody can be mistaken about that, and especially from Eddie Jones. But were you surprised that England didn't adapt quicker?
That's not for me to... You know, we knew where we were weak, and actually I think people saying that they adapted, I think we just had a switch off in the first couple of minutes of the second half, and a lot of that was due to the change in nine. I mean, Ugo Gori was not taken out. He was hit slightly late by Owen Farrell, and he had been absolutely brilliant, and he knew it inside out what to do in that first half. And Bronzini, who came on for us, got into it, but that first few minutes that he was on in the end of the first half, start of the second, he just wasn't at the same sort of level in terms of been doing that. We also knew we had to plug on the pick and go, and we left that unmarked for a little bit, and that's what you have to learn at the very highest level. With our team, one momentary switch off and you're punished. So I England did, they're a great side, and they won 16-17 games in a row for a reason, and I think it was just fun. You know, I actually enjoyed myself. I enjoyed the planning of the week. I enjoyed seen it happen, and we didn't know how it was going to work. You never do. It's been employed before, one-off little things in matches, but you know, we just decided we'd go for broke in this match and do something completely different from the start. So, I was really proud of the lads, the spirit they showed and the mentality, because keep on coming back to this thing. The amount we have to change to make Italy competitive again is huge, but we're learning at the highest level. But I think, I'd like to think people look and say, okay, well, they really are. They're not just going to do the norm and they're going to try and be different. And they see a huge spirit in a group of fellas who don't get half of what some of the other nations do at the moment. But as Ireland have proven through hard work and perseverance over a long period of time, and Scotland are beginning to prove that if you make the changes, it will turn around. And I've no doubt it will, whether it be on my watch or not. But we're going to try and make a big difference.
Just before I leave the Fox, if you had been with, say, Harlequins a few years ago and, say, Zebre had come over and deployed the Fox, do you think a Conor O'Shea team at Harlequins would have been quickly able to adapt, would have known what to do? What would you have done in that situation?
Well, we always like playing through the middle anyway, which is what people say about us quite a bit. So I think it suits. I think when it's sprung in you, it's very easy from the outside to... We had planned. We know where it's weak and we know where it's strong, and we knew what was coming. When you're hit with something, and there is this expectation, there was 82,000 people coming along just for a 70-point romp, and suddenly that's taken away. There's a pressure that puts on you, and you start looking for answers and questions. So I think Eddie will look back on that as just another part of the learning curve for his squad and say, well, actually, nothing just happens, and you have to expect some very strange and wonderful things on a rugby pitch. And everything we did was to the letter of the law. There was nothing that we did that was illegal. So we would never look to even do that. And, you know, there are things you see on a pitch on a regular basis that are actually illegal in terms of going to the letter of the law, whereas what we did was absolutely perfect. And hopefully not just that, hopefully seeing the ball going into Michele Campagnaro's hands early in the game from deep. It wasn't a team that just came not to play. We just wanted the ball back. And it was the way we wanted to get the ball back. There are other teams do it different ways.
Just two more questions. One, I've heard you talking about why try and contract the Six Nations. If anything, it should be expanded, because, of course, you're below Georgia, or have been below Georgia in the world rankings. You move in all the right circles to get a feeling for this kind of thing. Do you think there's a sniff of an expansion of the Six Nations?
I don't know, but all I know is I know I love the game, and I know how to ruin it and destroy it. And I know that you have a great country. I remember back when I was very young and hearing the great stories about the big Romanian packs, and then how that rugby country has been let dwindle a bit, but now is beginning to come back again. The international game is the driver of international rugby and our sport, and if we contract it in any way, shape or form, we're doing it a service for future generations. This is not about me and my job in Italy at the moment and stuff, because, you know, I'll be back and living in these islands in years to come. But I want to leave something behind that for a great rugby country, which hasn't moved at the times, but now we'll have to. And like with everything, I look at some of the players that have been blooded through and learning at the moment, and I think when they come out the other side and they're given the proper support, that you'll see a really, really strong competitive Italian side, which is what everyone wants. But you also look at what Milton Haig is doing at Georgia, and you look at the growth of rugby in places like Germany and Spain, and what you want to give a future. And if you can't plan for a future, you're going to contract the game, and we'll be sitting with a very boring, only a certain number of sides can win things, and you don't want the way to be. And Ireland grew from a difficult start of professionalism to where it is now. Scotland are coming out of a really difficult period in their history. And I think before the Six Nations, they'd only won one more game in their last 30 Six Nations games than Italy. I think 6 out of 30 compared to 5 out of 30. So, you know, it takes time. And if we put the right systems in place, we'll have some great days, we'll have some dark days. And hopefully we'll get a bit of luck, because I don't think, I felt pretty aggrieved for the team after the Welsh performance that we put in, that we were treated as we were on that day. And no complaints about Ireland. We made a lot of mistakes, but still felt the scoreline got away from us in the end a little bit, but there were no complaints. I felt very aggrieved and I felt very proud after the England game. We've been in the lead in two of the three half times now, and the lead against Wales 7-3 and 10-5 up against England, and don't think anyone could argue that we didn't deserve it in either of those games, but we have a lot of problems to solve.
Sure, and I saw your quote that you have a few other animals up your sleeves. you're not going to give us any details, of course not, but might we be looking out, should we be paying extra attention during the remaining two Six Nations matches?
I don't know, but in the fun that people are actually talking about, and I think it's great that, you know, rugby's a game about opinion, and people like seeing things that are a little bit different, and I think it's just nice that people are looking, probably going to be looking at us the next time we play and say, I wonder what they're going to come up with. And, you know, hopefully we'll have something up our sleeve.
Okay, listen, Conor, thanks very much for joining us and all the best.
Cheers, Gary.
So, Donald, that's Conor O'Shea chatting to Gary Moran earlier this week. I'm wondering if we fast forwarded a couple of weeks' time and Eddie Jones did this at the Aviva Stadium to win a Grand Slam, or if Joe Schmidt did it somewhere to win a game, would the same backlash have occurred as is happening to the poor, unfortunate minnows of Italy?
I don't think it would. But look, firstly, let's say this isn't a new innovation. I mean, it's... I have seen it on a number of occasions before. I was doing the commentary for RT Television with Hugh Cal, high up in Twickenham, and you could see this thing unfolding. And I've seen teams do it maybe two or three times in a game. I think the issue was we've never seen it happen continuously over the game, where you decide that you're not going to contest the ruck. In other words, the tackler and the tackled player are in situ on the ground. The opposition come in to try and engage the opposition, and nobody goes into the ruck. But, you know, England should have copped on early what was happening and made the adjustments accordingly. I think the area that was slightly different, as I say, is that Italy continued to do it in every single ruck, and England just seemed totally and utterly bemused.
The other element of it that I found most fascinating, and an awful lot has come out to say more of the interviews that BBC 5 Live did after the game, which they also videoed. So they've a long interview with Eddie Jones and they've a long interview with Conor O'Shea. And the point that was put to Jones at one point during his interview was, were you not able to get a message to the players during the game? And it's a reminder of maybe the systematic nature of modern test rugby, that these lads went out almost like robots to be programmed into how to play a game and what tactics to approach. And they didn't seem to have an ability to undo that process or think for themselves. And this is a team that has now won, 17 test matches.
Yeah, it is incredible when you look at it from that point of view. And, you know, if they're within two victories of creating history, no side ever has won 19 test games in a row. New Zealand came twice on a number of occasions. South Africa came twice, or came close a few years ago. But you have to ask yourself, in those situations, would New Zealand under Richie McCaw, if Ireland or England had adopted those tactics against them, would it take them 40 minutes to sort it out? Not in your life. If it was against Ireland, I would like to think that the players would be able to sort it out. But you could take it as absolutely red that an instruction would come in from the sideline. I thought it beggared belief that England went through a whole 40 minutes and never responded to what was happening. I mean, even sitting up, as I say, in the stand in commentary, I think I made the point during the game explaining to the viewers what was happening. You know, I couldn't understand why some of the England forwards just didn't pick and drive through the middle. There was no opposition there. You had to create a scenario where you drew the Italian players into the point of contact with the ball. But they didn't do that. The minute they did it, from the second half, I think Joe Launchbury did exactly that and made 30 metres. And the difference, England ended up scoring three tries, two tries in a sort of a 7-minute period after the break. It is a problem, I think, for some players in the modern game. They are scripted. They love to be told, this is what I expected of you. In phase play, in the next three phases, we expect you to be here, here, and here. But you have to react to what happens in front of you. And England just showed an amazing ability not to be able to do that.
And, you know, we can talk about what Conor O'Shea and his backroom staff did. It's certainly not in breach of the laws of the game. You can go on for ages about is it in breach of the spirit of the game, but you've got to do what you've got to do. And if anything's the case, the comments that came from Eddie Jones, now perhaps it was an honest answer to an honest question in terms of wanting to take Italy to the cleaners, but it's just disrespectful.
It is disrespectful, and I think he got what he deserved. His comments afterwards weren't much better. I mean, I know, you know, I wrote in my own column in the Irish Examiner this week, I made the point that Eddie Jones, you go back to when he was coach of Australia, you go back to the World Cup final against England in 2003. Australia had a very poor scrum at that stage. Al Baxter, their tight head, always struggled at international level. But they almost had a system where Australia looked so determined in terms of the set in the scrum, and Baxter always went to ground, forcing the referee into a series of resets so that by the end, all the referee wanted to do was get the ball in and the ball away. And it was a camouflage for how bad that Australian scrum was. Now, what Baxter was doing was illegal. Eddie Jones had no problem with that. But what Conor O'Shea and the tactics that Italy came up with were perfectly legal. They were playing within the laws of the game. Now, it's if I had paid £110 sterling to go into the match, I mightn't be happy. And I can tell you, the hundreds of England supporters who were sitting directly behind Hugh and myself, they weren't happy. But it was Conor O'Shea supposed to rock up to Italy, fulfil the script whereby they were going to be beaten by 60 or 70 points. Like, that was never going to happen. I remember going back to a long time ago now, 1998, I think it was. Brian Ashton was coach of Ireland. He had shingles. He was taken out. Warren Gatland was brought in before the game. We went over to France. I was involved in the management team at the time. And France were supposed to beat us by 50 points. Gatland just sort of galvanised everyone, got the public to send in text messages and messages of goodwill, and the whole dressing room was sort of plastered in these things. And, you know, Ireland put in a performance that day. We were leading with, I think, a couple of minutes to go, and in the end, I think France won by 3 points. I mean, you have to do what you have to do. There's no question. If Italy allowed England play their normal game, then England would have won by, you know, the same margin that Ireland did.
One last question. The Ireland squad named today for the final two rounds of the championship. Jarrod Payne comes back after his kidney injury. Joey Carberry comes back in after injury. We have Dave Kilcoyne back in the squad. Jack Conan's back in the squad. Ulton Dolan is there as well. No Tommy Bowe. Do you expect Joe Schmidt to shake things up for the game against Wales? Or is there a sense, maybe in a way, that you need to shake things up somewhere along the way to maintain the intensity amongst the rest of the lads that are in camp in Carton House?
Well, I think that's probably happened in that, you know, you go back to the last game against France, Peter Romani, Andrew Trimble and Johnny Sexton came back into the mix. I mean, it's incredible, really. And you have to take your hat off to the Irish strength and conditioning people and to the medical people, because, you know, the fact that practically every single player is available for selection now. Yeah, as I mentioned, those three players coming back in for the French game, Joey Carberry and Jarrod Payne, now coming back into the mix. Joe Schmidt is in an enviable position. Will he make changes? I think a lot depends on Rob Kearney. Seems to be carrying injuries into every single game, and, you know, struggled again, didn't last the pace the last day. Jarrod Payne, is it as he's played whatever number of minutes he played when he came on for Ulster last weekend? I notice he's starting at 13 for Ulster this weekend, so that would suggest, look, it's probably a game too early for him, unless he comes through completely unscathed and had a blinder. We know that Jarrod Payne is a player that Joe Schmidt has a huge amount of time for, but I think he's the only position that possible selection debate will happen, along with the back row. Wales have a particularly big back row. Is there merit, like they could bring back in Toby Faletau, is there merit in bringing in Peter Romani? I think that is a debate that will happen. But then it's very difficult to drop any of CJ Standard, Jamie Heaslip, or Sean O'Brien on their form at the moment.
It's a nice position to be in for Joe Schmidt. Final question, head above heart and everything else. As it stands, who's your favourite for the RBS Six Nations Championship?
I think England are still in the favourite slot. I think you'll see a reaction against from England when they play Scotland. That's going to be another fascinating game. Really looking forward to that one. I think there has to be a performance in England. They haven't played well in any of the three games they've played in the Championship to date. I notice, believe Vunipola is back in the Saracen squad for the weekend. Whether that means he becomes available to England for the final two games in the Championship remains to be seen. But I think if it does, he is a serious addition to that England setup. But that said, having watched them in the flesh last week, there is nothing there that would suggest to me that Ireland would have any reservations about playing them in Dublin on that last day. So England are still marginal favourites for me. If Ireland get through the game in Wales, that game in Dublin is one not to be missed.
Yeah, certainly is. We look forward to it. Donal, appreciate your time as always. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure, Damien.
Donal Lenehan bringing the RTE Rugby Podcast to a close this week. Thanks to Robbie Irwin, who looked after the shop. From Damien O'Mara, till we chat again. Good luck.
The RTE Rugby Podcast.